From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The U.S. economy is booming for the wealthiest 1% of Americans. Stocks are strong, tax reform has funneled more money into their pockets, and in general, wealth is safely stored in the hands of fewer Americans than ever before. The rest of us, we're not doing so well. We're expected to do contract work, find ways to get by in the so-called gig economy, and blame only ourselves when we can't make ends meet. But increasingly, Americans have realized there is value in cooperation, sharing, and solidarity. The idea of cooperatives to share the work and the wealth is an old one that surges in popularity during times of economic crisis. My guest, Nathan Schneider, has written a book about the revival of the cooperative economy. He's a journalist and professor of media studies at the University of Colorado in Boulder and has written for numerous publications, including The Nation, The New Republic, New York Times, and Catholic Worker. Nathan Schneider now joins me to talk about his book, Everything for Everyone, the radical tradition that is shaping the next economy. Welcome to the program, Nathan.
I'm glad to be back on. Thanks for having me.
So how does one define what a cooperative is? Some of us may have come in contact with, you know, co-op supermarkets or grocery stores, but I think it's still not necessarily a household word in the United States. So how do you define a co-op or cooperative?
Well, the cooperative, I think of as a kind of business in which the people who participate in it most are those who own and govern it. So that can be workers who own the business where they work, or customers who own the business where they shop, or people who are depositing money in a credit union owning that institution as well. Or it can be a business made up of small businesses that buy their stock together in order to compete with big chains. It's a very flexible and dynamic model. Often we come in with, we hear cooperative and we think of, you know, one kind of cooperative that we've interacted with, but there are so many different kinds, and they can take so many different forms.
So does, say, being a shareholder in a company make you an owner?
Well, being a shareholder in, say, a publicly traded company, you know, having stock from the stock market is kind of different. You know, that's a relationship that's designed around the financial return that you might be able to get from that. And a cooperative membership is different. In that case, you are not just in it for a financial return, but you are able to guide the business in a way that includes its fuller mission and its purpose. It allows, I think, owners to be fuller human beings in their relationship to the economy, to make decisions that go beyond just their short-term financial interest. And that's part of what is drawing a new generation into this movement. The appeal of a kind of business and economy where we can be our fuller selves, where we can bring our concerns about our communities and the environment and work conditions and so much more into the decisions that we make.
So it's not just about money, but it's about values.
It can be. And it's a movement, too, that has grown up for generations alongside the development of industrial capitalism. And as a movement, it has a set of principles that commit it to concern for community, cooperation among cooperative businesses, a range of other values, education of its members, things that go just beyond business as usual, but that call these kind of businesses to a higher mission.
Now, what is the, I'm sure you could write whole books on the history of cooperatives, but is it an American tradition? Is it something that, you know, goes back to ancient times that people have, you know, is a cooperative institution a very old form of designing an economy?
Well, yeah, you can go back as far as you want, really, but I think it's most useful to focus on the development of these kinds of businesses in the early industrial period, around the time when the modern publicly owned, publicly traded company was being developed. And actually in England, the laws that enabled cooperatives to form actually preceded those for the modern corporation. This was a kind of business that people would form when they were pooling their resources and trying to do something on their own. It was, in a way, the original crowdfunding. And in the U.S., cooperatives were especially important after the Civil War in the development of the agricultural sector. And farmers used cooperatives to be able to bypass urban bankers and railroad barons and people who didn't have their best interests at heart. And through that, they actually built a populist movement in the late 19th century that was taking power all around the country on the basis of this cooperative entrepreneurship, on the basis of the economic power that they were able to build through cooperatives. And you still see the effects of these those early co-ops in you know, present day co-ops like Sunkist or Land O'Lakes Butter or Organic Valley. These are descendants of that long tradition of farmer cooperative organizing in this country.
So are we seeing a resurgence in cooperatives and setting them up, or in cooperatives that are already existing growing in this economy that is more and more not serving the vast majority of Americans?
Well, yeah, there's a growing interest, especially since the financial crisis of 2008, and this has been really exciting for this new generation who are kind of rediscovering the cooperative movement. A lot of my attention has been focused on people in the tech economy, people who are trying to envision a different kind of internet than the one that Silicon Valley is offering, where people are building online platforms, social media, data, labor platforms that are owned and governed by the people that they serve rather than simply the early venture capital investors. At the same time, the older cooperative movement, in many ways has been losing steam, has been consolidating. Businesses are combining with each other. In some cases, they're returning to a cooperative identity or reviving it. In other cases, they've kind of forgotten it. So we have an opportunity here, I think, to, on the one hand, create a new generation of cooperative businesses, but on the other, to revive the incredible legacy that we have all around us and that we've kind of forgotten how to notice, see, and value.
So in looking at the kinds of cooperatives that we're now seeing popping up in this economy, let's talk about some of the examples that you write in your book. And the book is called Everything for Everyone, which sounds like a utopian ideal. One of the disruptors in the taxi industry, to use a favorite tech industry phrase, have been the rideshare companies Uber and Lyft and others. And it seems as though everybody now has friends that drive for one or both of these companies, or even family members. And these are people who might have had good jobs in the past, good job prospects, might be educated, but to make ends meet, they're riding Uber on the or working for Uber on the weekends, and that is supposed to be what we're satisfied with. Are there examples of alternatives to these rideshare companies that are built on a cooperative model where the drivers are actually own a stake in the company?
Yeah, it's a really interesting case. We've kind of been told that only a super large company like Uber that's taking over the world could possibly deliver this kind of convenient service and, flexible work and so forth, and that they can only deliver it on those terms of close to criminal wages, if not already there. And in fact, a few years ago, the city of Austin passed a rule that required Uber and Lyft to comply with the same rules for fingerprinting drivers for security that all the taxis had to follow. And Uber and Lyft said, no way, we're not going to do this, and they left. And then the city helped establish a taxi cooperative, ATX Taxi Co-op, a cooperatively owned taxi company among the drivers, and then a nonprofit rideshare called Ride Austin. That charged drivers just $1 per ride, much better rate than Uber and Lyft offered. And it also enabled people, as they're taking their rides, to donate to local nonprofits, and so to really contribute to the community that they're visiting. And it's still working. Unfortunately, it's lost a lot of its market share since the state overruled the city and let Uber and Lyft back. But it demonstrates what's possible when our local governments and communities decide, hey, we're not going to give away our transportation infrastructure to a multinational corporation. We're going to build, you know, local tools. The software is actually, you know, very possible to build on a local basis, and especially if communities like that are sharing across communities, creating kind of cooperatives of cooperatives. This repeats itself over and over. If we were to put up what are really reasonable barriers in front of these Silicon Valley disruptors and expect that we have local control in our digital economy, as the people of Austin did, we could do amazing things. But we've been kind of hoodwinked into this idea that that only big, super, heavily capitalized, venture-backed firms could possibly bring this technology to us.
Right. I mean, the actual drivers of these rideshare companies make so little money precisely because there's a profit motive built into it for the executives of the corporation, for the shareholders. But I'm sure people who actually use these rideshare services would much rather the vast majority of the money that they spend on the rides goes to the driver. I know I certainly, when I use those services, wish that that would happen. Let's talk about banking. Los Angeles just recently had a sadly unsuccessful attempt to vote in a public bank, but we've had credit unions around the country. Are credit unions considered cooperatives?
Yes, the credit union is in a sense a kind of a branding term that was. Brought up through Edward Filene of, you know, Filene's Basement, the department store mogul who became obsessed with the credit union idea after discovering the model in Quebec, and brought the movement to the United States and helped pass some of the enabling legislation. And in a way, that language of credit union has been very powerful. You know, about a third of Americans are members of credit unions. It's an incredibly successful and important model in this country. But the terminology also kind of disguises the fact that, yes, these are cooperatives. They're essentially, you know, cooperative local banks. And this is a way of doing finance that I think we really need to double down on and emphasize in a moment where, rightly, we've lost so much faith in the corporate banking sector. And I think that means we need to think bigger. You know, the credit union system was designed to be, you know, small and local and kind of a small scale deal. I think it's time for us to think about what would it take for us to scale up this kind of democratic finance to the level where these institutions can actually take on some of the big banks. And that's something that we're lacking. We've kind of designed the system so that big corporate banks run the show and credit unions are passing around the crumbs, but it really doesn't have to be that way.
It seems to me that a lot of the reasons why Americans go with these big companies is convenience because of, you know, online services, apps that make your life easier, super easy to, you know, get a ride or deposit your check. But that is very easily doable, even by small corporations these days. It doesn't take that many resources to build an app, for example, and simply mimic what the big corporations have done and do it on a small scale and offer that same convenience to others, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, some of these are very capital intensive efforts, and there's a lot of risk involved. So that means that we do need a new generation of policy and strategy for financing these kinds of businesses. You know, in the 1920s and 30s around that time, farmers, for instance, were quite well organized through farmers unions across the country, and they were able to demand and fight for a financial system that enabled them to finance cooperatives. So, you know, down the road from me in Denver, there's a $128 billion bank called CoBank that is a cooperative, and it finances cooperative agriculture. That kind of system needs to be built in other sectors. I think we need, the framework to enable cooperative venture capital. A system where we're able to finance the technology of the future on a basis that's compatible with shared ownership. And that could mean that, an entrepreneur creates a business and then, their exit, rather than selling to Wall Street or to a big company, is to sell to their users. A model where, you do it from the beginning. I'm involved in a new equity accelerator for cooperatives called Start.coop. And we're trying to develop a model where we can actually enable bigger co-ops to invest in startups through this accelerator. And so there are a lot of strategies, but part of the thing that's really important to recognize is the system is really designed for big corporate banks and for finance that is seeking short-term profits. And we need to recognize that we need a new generation of tools and support to enable this kind of financing to be at least as accessible and available to people developing great new business ideas, so that entrepreneurs don't have to, have the option of choosing democracy, and maybe have an incentive to do so.
Is the idea of cooperative structures in our economy antithetical to capitalism or consistent with it?
Well, it depends what you mean by capitalism. Capitalism has kind of propagandized itself into our minds, into making us think that things like markets and competition, innovation, entrepreneurship, free enterprise, being able to choose where you work and what you do, and putting some imagination to it, that all of that is capitalism. If that's the case, maybe this is capitalism. But I tend to think of capitalism as a system in which the whole economy is run at the behest of a very small capital class that is seeking financial returns as the primary objective of any enterprise. In that case, we're talking about something that is not that kind of capitalism. We're talking about something that is running on a very different kind of basis.
Nathan, a number of examples that you chronicle in your book are of cooperatives outside the United States. This is certainly not an American phenomenon. What are some co-ops that you can share with us that can offer some great models for the United States and the U.S. economy?
Well, one example is Italy, which has developed a really fantastic national cooperative sector, especially in the north, but all over the country. And this was actually the product of organizing for generations by both Catholics, inspired by the Catholic social teaching, and communists. And they both kind of developed some similar models, and they developed kind of a national framework together, despite disagreeing about most other things. And one of the things that they ensured was that cooperatives actually are expected to pay a portion of their profits to an association that then invests in developing and financing new cooperatives. And so they have a framework to enable the sector to self-finance and grow. And again, that's a result of generations. Another thing the Italians have done differently from us is, a lot of our, healthy local organic food movement was developed through retail cooperatives like the Park Slope Food Co-op in Brooklyn, or producer cooperatives like Organic Valley. But we didn't really allow those to grow with the market. So Whole Foods ended up swooping in and essentially taking over the market that the cooperatives had built for it. And in Italy, they did that differently. Rather than just keeping the cooperatives pure and kind of precious and, focused on only the best possible things, they now, the largest grocery store chain in the country in Italy is a cooperative. And some stores look like a Whole Foods and some stores look like a Target. They chose to manage their own compromises through cooperatives rather than keeping their cooperatives small and pure.
I want to come back to what you were saying earlier about the kinds of policy making that needs to happen to enable more cooperatives or enable our economy to be friendly to cooperatives. So this is in the realm of political action, right? So are there bills in place, either at the state level or at the federal level, that need to be supported or even introduced, and that our elected officials need to be pushed into supporting as a move toward addressing income inequality? I mean, really couching it, framing it in those terms. I mean, the rich get tax giveaways. What about the rest of us? The least that our legislators can do is make it easier to form cooperatives so that we can build our own wealth and share in it.
Well, we're in a really exciting moment right now, actually, where there's a surprising bipartisan consensus around this idea. If you look at
Wow, that is
the
rare.
party platforms of 2016, both the Democrats and Republicans say that we should expand employee ownership. They have different reasons for saying it. The Democrats are interested in, reducing income inequality and so forth, and the Republicans are interested in, spreading ownership and entrepreneurship. But the end is the same. This is something that both Paul Ryan and Bernie Sanders have been interested in for a long time. And so it's really a powerful opportunity. And just a few months ago, the Main Street Employee Ownership Act quietly passed as part of the defense appropriation bill, and that is the first piece of legislation in a number of years that eases the way for conversions to employee ownership of existing businesses and using Small Business Administration loans to do that. It's a very exciting opportunity, and we have a chance to build on that. My dream, in a way, is to see a kind of a return to the model that was used in agriculture in the 20s and 30s, where the federal government essentially leveled the playing field and enabled cooperatives in rural areas to have access to bank rate loans, access to capital at the same cost as big banks do. And that spurred an incredibly successful nationwide cooperative development boom. I think we should generalize that across the economy and say, look, cooperative businesses should have access to the same cost of capital as corporate banks, and make sure that they have a chance to have a real place in the economy and raise the bar for values and service in this economy. It's a chance to kind of transform this economy from within, to build on models that powerful people's organizations have fought for and won in the past. And I think we're actually in an interesting position to do that again. But we need to recognize that opportunity.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Nathan. Good luck to you with the book.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Nathan Schneider, journalist and professor of media studies at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's written for a number of publications, including The Nation, New Republic, New York Times, and Catholic Worker. We've been discussing his new book, Everything for Everyone: The Radical Tradition That Is Shaping the Next Economy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.